Hi folks, welcome to the A Minute to Midnight show. Coming to you from New Zealand, Tony here, and with me on the show I have John Haller in Ohio, and John's obviously a frequent guest on this show, and it'll be interesting to cover some of the subjects we are going to be covering today. Welcome, John.
Good to be with you.
It's good to be with you too.
It's a shame though, I always hate coming on here when there's nothing to talk about.
like that's every time.
Usually, you know, it just seems like everything just, it's like, sometimes people send you an email and you don't respond to them. And so then the next one is really extreme. And then the next one is in all caps and they're telling you all this really crazy, crazy stuff because they're trying to get your attention. And so I feel like, you know, it's like the volume keeps getting turned up at the party, the annoying party next door. So you're paying attention to them and listening because there's a lot of stuff going on. It's very bizarre. I did a radio interview this morning about our church for a local, they have a thing they've done for years, Church of the Week. So they've done hundreds of these of churches. So we're coming up next week. So we're talking about the church and everything. And I told them about, you know, I've been doing these prophecy updates for a long, long time. And it used to be I would do a teaching and then I would do the 10 minutes of maybe what I thought prophecy related news was. This is back in the early 2000s. And now it's like, well, I'm going to cut off after an hour and a half just because I don't want to bore people listening to my voice too long. And because I could go for 3 hours more after going an hour and a half, you know, like I did somebody with somebody last night and I think we went 2 hours and 10 minutes. And we didn't really even, we sort of got off topic in the first 20 minutes and talked about all this other stuff. Cause there's just a lot of things going on that I think are prophecy related. And that's sort of what I've always talked about is, you know, I've sort of came up with the grid for a Canadian conference I was doing 2 years ago where I have acceleration, convergence, logistics, and understanding that all these things that are prophesied, they sort of have these elements or they fit within the acceleration and convergence thing. And that's one thing you see everywhere you look. Sunday, I referred back to a Financial Times article from November. I think it was October 29th, Financial Times op-ed page. And the guy talked, you know, welcome to the world, the age of the polycrisis. And if you notice a couple months later, that was the theme that, Klaus Schwab and everybody was talking about at Davos. We live in the age, welcome to the world of the polycrisis. And that comes from a French philosopher back in the 90s. But I was using it in a title back in October based on that article in Financial Times. And it certainly is the age of the polycrisis because it's like, what's today going to be like? And I was thinking with PM had a little health issue last week. Allergic reaction, and we think to some eye drops at the eye doctor, and they had to, her blood pressure went to like 330 over 180, which is not good. And she's having bad chest pains and everything and flushed feeling. So the eye doctor that she was at called the emergency squad. So they took her by emergency squad over to one of the ERs, and she's fine now. Everything's normal and that type of thing. But, it's sort of like, well, what's next? You know, it's just like, what's tomorrow going to be like? And I was thinking like, it'd be really great if we could just kind of roll back to 2019 and kind of start over. Not that 2019 was that great, but compared to what we're going through now, it actually was pretty nice.
Well, certainly things are escalating, that's for sure. And it feels very different than it did before 2019, I have to say. But man, I mean, as a New Zealander at the moment, we're going through, well, we've had Cyclone Gabrielle hit here a few days ago, and it's done widespread damage to New Zealand. I mean, it's probably going to end up to be the most costly weather event ever in the history of New Zealand, I think. So far, at least 5 confirmed deaths. I think there'll be probably considerably more because there's still a lot of communities completely cut off with no communications. And it's certainly unlike anything I've seen, apart from maybe 1988, we had Cyclone Bola. But I think this may even surpass Cyclone Bola. And for those in the Northern Hemisphere, basically it's an equivalent. It's just another word for a hurricane, really. We just call them cyclones down here. And it was masses of wind and heavy rain, and flooding has been unbelievable. Luckily, right where I am, we got hit, you know, by the wind and the rain pretty hard, but we haven't got the flooding. But I don't have to go far from here, and there are flooded out areas, and I've taken photos and video of some of it, and there are. Well, I see even this morning, though, causing an evacuation in a town that's probably about 20 minutes from here because of rising river levels and so on. And the main cities closest to me, they've been some of the hardest hit places in New Zealand. They're closer to the coast. I'm more inland. But really, you know, that's where some of these deaths have occurred. That's where I go, you know.
So is it wind that you're having, or wind and heavy rains?
Both, extreme. It's dropped off now. The cyclone's moved away. But the thing is, everything is now so wet that even smaller amounts of rain exasperate what there is, because it was insane amounts of rain and very high winds coordinated at the same time. And, yeah, we're in a – the whole country's in a – what they call level 4 emergency, national emergency, which is the highest level. So, but the wind has dropped away here now, and there's not raining here at the moment, but there is more rain forecast. And as I say, I mean, some of what I've seen, and I'm not in the worst hit area, even though I'm, you know, within striking distance of it. I mean, I've seen flooding levels and things which are pretty amazing, and lots of wind damage. I actually got up to my cabin yesterday to check it out to make sure of no damage. Well, that was one heck of a mission. I'll probably do a getting to the cabin video sometime in the next little while, because, yeah, I had to walk the last part of it. But, man, there was just flooding and trees down and slips and all sorts. So it's pretty bad.
I'm looking at pictures here. So you're heading into fall, right?
Yeah, it's like February's the last official month of summer. It's normally our hottest month, but it hasn't been hot, not where I am. Apart from a few days, it's been below average temperatures as well. And it's been a ridiculous summer. It's been the summer that wasn't just about where I am so far.
Well, we've had a strange winter. I have a snowblower, so I've used it twice this winter. One was a pretty heavy snow, maybe 8-10 inches, and then the other was a not as much snow but much heavier, because it was like it came down like slush, and then it got really cold, so whatever I blew off the driveway turned into like ice, little ice mountains. As it was just very bizarre. And now today, so we're in mid-February, February 15th, and I just was over at the golf course at the driving range. And it's 72 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah,
that's here. Yeah. But tomorrow's supposed to be 22.
Yeah, I mean, that's crazy. That's all over the place. That is. So, yeah, I mean, our weather has definitely been strange. And this is what they're going to use to keep pushing their narrative for global warming and climate change, of course. So they're already talking about that here. How now do you believe in climate change or global warming, you know, with our cyclone and all that. But to cap off the cyclone, we had a 6.3 earthquake last night as well. So it was not strong enough for me to dive for cover, but it was kind of at that shall I not level. Luckily, yeah. No damage, but obviously 6.3 is a reasonably big quake. It was off the coast away, closer to where I used to live, actually. But it's a little unsettling, all of these things going on. And so, yeah, New Zealand feels like we're right under the hammer at the moment, I'll be completely honest. And then, you've got under the hammer in Ohio in other ways, John, which has also been big news.
So, yeah, I could talk about this. So East Palestine, Ohio, which is over near the Ohio-Pennsylvania border, so eastern Ohio, western Pennsylvania, and it's about roughly 30 minutes outside of Pittsburgh. I sort of grew up not too far from East Palestine, but from here it's about a 2.5-hour drive. It's about 150 miles. and we are upwind from whatever's going on over there. So I don't think we're in any danger. And these train derailments, they're fairly common in the United States. Our infrastructure is not in the best shape. And just to give you a little background, I mean, I was a lawyer for a long time, and early in my career, I did work litigation involving representing railroads, representing some chemical companies, and I had some train derailments and things that I worked on even up until the 1990s. So I know a little bit about the thinking, I think, that goes into the people that are dealing with the derailment. I did work with some of the people and some of the state agencies that I saw talking, some of the doctors and that type of thing from the different Ohio departments of health and that type of thing a few years back on some litigation. So I know a little bit about what's going on. So let me just kind of give you the take is, one, I don't think what happened there was good. But when you analyze a train derailment, the thing that I kind of object to right now is everybody's doing the sensational, you know, mass depopulation event that occurs in Ohio and that type of thing. And I don't know that's happened. One, if that's going to happen, it's going to take a while, maybe a couple decades to figure this out, exactly what happened and what the exposures are. So when you have a train derailment, what people want to do is you want to look at what was spilled, how toxic is it? At what level does it become toxic to human beings, life, water tables, that type of thing? And how are we going to contain it and deal with it? Now, what's interesting about this derailment, so I'll be upfront with you, that right now my gut tells me that there is a good possibility that this is a Russian sabotage operation as part of the ongoing conflict in Ukraine and Russia, which the United States, I mean, Russia has said, we're at war with you guys. And a German minister said, yeah, we're at war with Russia. So I really do think that we're in the beginnings of World War III, and Russia's making all kinds of claims and bombastic claims about what they're going to do, how they're going to do this. And I'm looking at a Norwegian Defense Forces report about Russia, and it says Russia deploys nuclear armed ships for the first time in 30 years. Tactical nuclear weapons are a particularly serious threat, the intelligence report says. And it does. I was translating it from Norwegian with Google Translate. So in the context of that war that's going on, and remember, one of the seminal moments in that, now almost a week from Friday will be 1 year anniversary of the Russian-Ukraine war, when Russia invaded Ukraine. This one of the seminal events was the bomb attack on the bridge in Crimea. It's a multi-tiered bridge, very long bridge. It has it might have three travel spans, and then it also has a railroad span. And with the Ukrainians will clearly claim that they did this, and I've becomes friends with a pastor in Ukraine. So I've spent many hours on the phone with him and talking to him over the last couple of months. I just talked to him last Monday. And they say, we did this. And it was an amazing operation because the truck blew up and the train was on the tracks, you know, going the same direction as the truck. But when the truck blew up, it was right when the fuel oil cars on the train. So whoever blew it up was either incredibly lucky or it was an incredibly well-planned operation. And I'm thinking the latter, because there are probably no secrets in the world today. So they would have known, Ukraine would have been able to figure out that this train was carrying, assuming they hacked into the Russian systems or whatever, this train was carrying fuel oil and it was going to be going along here. And they timed this truck to explode when the fuel oil cars were right alongside the truck, even though they were going the same direction, but at different speeds. So it's an amazing operation. And that fire, my understanding is, I believe the rail span is still not operational. They've been able to restore some of the travel lanes on the bridge. so they can use the bridge to move equipment and things from Russia across Crimea into areas of Ukraine. But Russia has always sort of the way that Russia moves troops, armaments, equipment has been by rail. So not having that rail is a very big deal. So you now, and you also have this article that came out last week by Seymour Hersh, who usually has truth in his articles, but I believe he sensationalizes it because he's very anti-American in his orientation. And that's okay, but you just have to kind of filter what he says. And he says the United States did Nord Stream. So if we did Nord Stream, there is a good chance, I think, that Russia caused this train derailment in East Palestine, Ohio. And it's in kind of an important area. It's in an area near a lot of farmland, a lot of agriculture, and it's also, there's water that drains into the Ohio River. And there's some claims that the Ohio River is already contaminated somewhat with vinyl chloride. So when they get these train derailments, this is based on my experience as a lawyer who worked on with railroads who had these problems, because they're going to be, believe me, this is a lawyer, in some respects, this is kind of a lawyer's dream, because there's going to be litigation over this for a very, very long time, assuming the lawyer doesn't return. Which we're hoping for at this point, even more so than we did before. But so you have to figure out what was there. But there's also some video that is circulating now of a security camera video of the train 20 miles before the derailment, and there's fire coming from a couple of the train cars. Now, that fire could be caused by something across the track. It could ignite. Let's say that the cars were carrying wheat or something like that. That's highly flammable. And when the fire happens, if the fire's just in the – when a rail car is put on, it's the top part is put on what they call the trucks, the wheels. And it just sits on top. They don't fasten it or anything like that because it's so heavy, they don't have to do that. But when it starts to crash, it can do. And so it could be possible that this fire, it's not hot enough to melt the steel, but sort of like some of the theories on 9/11, it's hot enough that it weakens the steel. And so the wheels change over time. They will get out of alignment, and you just need to get one of these cars going, and boom, you got the whole thing piled up. So I don't think it's a highly complex sabotage operation, and everybody's infrastructure in the world is highly vulnerable to these type of things. So I wouldn't put it past Russia, because they've been saying, you know, they're going to do things to us because of Nord Stream, and they hold us responsible. And there's this article last week, and then the article kind of comes out, and it's sort of in Russia's face. Are you going to do anything about this or not? That's what, you know, Russian, pro-Russian people would be saying. So that's what I think happened. So what happened was, though, the train derailed. It had a lot of vinyl chloride, and vinyl chloride is very common, used in manufacturing, like for PVC pipe and that type of thing. Polyvinyl chloride is the technical name. And it's toxic at certain levels. And I think what happened was they saw the problem that they had. So I'm going to try to walk you through what I think the people that were dealing with this were thinking. I know everybody wants to say, well, they were planning on making it as bad as possible. And I don't know that. I mean, there are people in Ohio and these different government agencies. They want to deal with this problem because it's not good for them politically. So they go out there and they look at it and get this polyvinyl chloride, and we don't want that to leak into the water table or the rivers. And some did already, but it depends on the terrain, and I don't know the exact terrain there. But I would say there are rolling hills in that area of Ohio as you're getting close to the Ohio River. And the rivers, there's pretty heavy stream and river system there. There's a lot of rivers and streams. And so they don't want it to get in the water table because you get a contaminated water table and you're just at a point where people can't live there. And you don't want it to get into the river because it can flow downstream and it can cause problems. Although the river, the Ohio River is a pretty big river, so it's going to dilute things to a pretty big degree. But the unusual thing that they did was they set the thing on the chemicals on fire, and they did like a burn. Now the question is it a controlled burn or just a crazy burn? But now you see this almost like black toxic mushroom cloud of chemicals burning there in East Palestine, and it's blowing downwind. And there have been a lot of reports that there are poultry farmers, a guy who raises foxes, that the animals are sick, they've died, and that sort of thing. I don't know that anybody has died, but they were told to leave. And the governor in this announcement, Governor DeWine, said, you need to get out. We need to get out because this is very toxic and you can't stay here anymore. And then there was an incident where a reporter who was trying to ask some questions was arrested or taken away by the police. So it's sort of a piling on of all these things, and everybody says, oh, well, they're really trying to do something. So they're either trying to do something or maybe they're just incompetent and they don't know what to do. And it's a difficult situation because you got this chemical and you can't let it get into the water. But if it's in such a terrain where you can't contain it to keep it from getting into the water, the choice then seems to be, the rational choice seems to be, well, burn the thing, burn the stuff. And you know, with the wind blowing and everything, it'll dissipate the gases that come off of burning this one of which is phosgene and that type of thing. So I don't know what their thinking is. I'm just telling you, based on experience and having walked through this with people that have been involved in this before, that these are some of the things that they were thinking about. But we have a problem there. And it's a problem that could exist for a long time now. I don't know the half-life breakdown characteristics of polyvinyl chloride. I know that I had some litigation involving PCBs many years ago. They stopped manufacturing those about 1979. But that didn't deal with the PCB problem, which were in these transformers, electric power stations, pumps that used, you know, that help pump gas and everything. We have this incredibly complex and extensive pipeline system in the United States. And you'll have a diesel pipeline, you'll have a gasoline pipeline, you'll have oil, you'll have natural gas and everything. So they're pipelines all over the place. And they're protected somewhat because they're mostly underground. But they have to have lift stations and pumps and that type of thing. And so at these pumps, they would lubricate. The lubricant would be a thing called PCBs. And it contains dioxin, which is really toxic. And the thing about the reason they used the PCBs is they never broke down. You never had to change the oil because they were in these machines for years running, and the oil still maintained its lubricant characteristics. But then the problem with PCBs was why they were so welcomed by industry. Industry liked it because they didn't break down, and they were toxic because they didn't break down. Yeah. And so if they seeped out into the environment, which they did, these things are there for hundreds of years without breaking down. And that can be a problem. So I don't know the breakdown half-life. Well,
John, we don't also know whether there are other chemicals in those wagons either, because they haven't really said, have they? How many wagons was it? 20 or something? 20 carriages with chemicals in?
Yeah. And those carriages you get a rail car and you load it up. You can load it up with, you know, it's like you get a, I've been inside like a grain car, and it's like ice in there because they want they coat it with something so that if you get in there and you slip and fall, you're going to the bottom. And it's really hazardous, but you get the grain dust, but you put tons and tons and tons and tons of grain in one of those cars. So by the same token, you know, there's probably, I don't know the characteristic. I've heard like 10 million pounds of chemicals in these cars that derailed. So if they're 20 cars, that would be 500,000 pounds. That would be 250 tons. That probably seems a little bit high to me, but there's a lot of stuff there.
Yeah.
And we don't know what all of it is yet. And then the other thing you don't know is what happens when the tanker breaks open and it mixes with something else.
Exactly. The mixture of the chemicals. That's where you're always going. Yeah.
And I'm just saying is if somebody's doing a sabotage operation, you know, and they know this, they've caused a lot of problems for a lot of people. And they've disrupted a lot of lives. Now it's a relatively rural area, but it's only, I think you can be downtown Pittsburgh in 30 minutes from there. So it's, you know, and Pittsburgh's a big city. And so, and then what happens with the wind? So where we live, we're 150 miles away roughly, but we're upwind. So the wind's not blowing, the prevailing winds do not blow our direction. And now it's been out there for about a week or so. And so it's dissipated, but there's still stuff on the ground. But they're not being very transparent. And the feds, the federal government aspect, which would probably fall under Peter Buttigieg's responsibility, have been pretty much, you would say, absent from the whole situation.
And well, now he's blaming Trump. Trump era policies for the derailment. That was I saw this morning. But yeah, I mean, it's a concern, the whole thing. And Holly's been worried too because her family are in Weirton, West Virginia, which is also not very far from there.
Yeah, I'm going to guess it's probably about 30 miles south of where this happened.
Yeah,
roughly.
Yeah, and then the Ohio River flows down there. So I don't know the area right well. I can sort of visualize it having just driven through, you know, very briefly. But, yeah, it's kind of – so she's a little –
well, you're
worried.
Down in that area where there's really not a lot of ways across the river either.
No.
It's – so, yeah, that's – it's – it. Listen, the bottom line is this is not a good situation for anybody. Yeah. And – the government seems to be rather detached or incompetent in the way they're dealing with it. And they're not, the worst thing they can do in these situations is not be honest with people, like what's going on and what's going to happen. And so now you have a community, it's not a big town, but you have this community and they're like, what's going to happen to us? And, nobody knows. And so people are like, I'm leaving, I'm never coming back. And these things can devastate a town. There was a famous chemical problem up in, I can't remember what the name of it was. It was sort of an American Chernobyl up around Niagara Falls with toxic chemicals that were in the ground and everything. And it's, so that, I'm looking at the map here. It looks like the leak area on Google Maps is almost right at the state line, the Ohio-Pennsylvania state line. But you can see that there are creeks and everything that drain into the Ohio River, which is not that far away. So
I think people that don't realize that you've kind of got that junction of West Virginia, Ohio, and Pennsylvania are all pretty close in that.
Correct.
So three states
correct.
Impacted.
So south of there would be there's a town called East Liverpool, which is on the border, the Ohio River. Then when you get south of there, about you're maybe 10 miles south of the Ohio River, which would form the border then between Ohio, Pennsylvania, and West Virginia. It kind of flows through there. So it's, you know, it's a conjunction of these three states, and it's only 30 miles from Pittsburgh. And the wind would probably, the prevailing wind and the way the plume, that's the area of toxic exposure, looks like it's in the direction of Pittsburgh. But it does, I don't know that it goes that far. I don't know. what the wins were. This is something people are going to be analyzing for a lot of years. Yeah. But again, my initial gut reaction says that I would not rule out Russian sabotage, and the fact that 20 miles before the derailment, there seems to be some video indicating that there was already some kind of fire going on in at least two of the railroad cars.
Yeah, it's just a little suspect.
Well, I've seen a lot of trains. I mean, we have a bunch, you know, a couple double, triple tracks not too far from us. And I see a lot of trains, you know, and I can tell you this, in representing railroad companies for a while in my legal career, I've never watched trains going down the tracks where they're on fire, like what I saw in some of the videos here. So something's not right. And and these trains, they send out signals in, like, I've been in these big train operation centers, like down in Norfolk, Virginia, and they can tell you where every train, every car, and everything is, and the whole rail system of, like, in that case, it was Norfolk Southern Railroad. It's an amazing board. And this was 30, 40 years ago that they had this. You can imagine what they have now with the technology. So it's a big deal. We don't know what'll happen, but it's just one thing that you add to the mix. It kind of, I guess, got our minds off of the war in Ukraine, the bad economy, and the balloons all over the place. Or maybe the balloons were to distract us from something else that's going on that we shouldn't be paying attention to. That's another weird thing that's going on. Yeah, in this world.
It certainly is. Okay, so you know, as our time's going on, so what do you make of the situation? You know, you mentioned Russia and the Ukraine and the potential World War III. Maybe we're already in the early phases of it. What are your thoughts on what's been going on in that arena?
You know, I probably have a little different view than some other people, just because I've become acquainted with this Ukrainian pastor friend, and I asked him a question last week, and he said, I'll get back to you when I have electricity and internet, because, you know, Russia's destroying the infrastructure in Ukraine. And I have a feeling that if Russia is successful in moving forward with this offensive operation, it's going to be very bad. And I did ask my friend, I said, I've heard these rumors that Russia is kidnapping Ukrainian children and taking them to Russia. Russia has a bad demographic problem. And this has been common in the conflicts between Russia and Ukraine over the centuries. And he says, yeah, it's in the tens of thousands in the last year. And so we're trying to figure out, like, as a church, what we can do. Is there some way we can help some of the Ukrainian people? You know, I saw a video of a person, I think in Kyiv, being drugged off by Ukrainian security forces to be forced into the armed forces. And my friend had told me, listen, they've done this with thousands of Ukrainians. They've drugged them off to put them into the Russian army to fight Ukrainians. And this has been a fairly common thing. So we have a very big mess there. Let me just bring in one thing from Davos that I think is significant. People might want to look at. There was a guy at Davos on one of the panels, and his name was, I think it's Alex Karp, K-A-R-P. And he's one of these really smart guys, because he's like Einstein. In fact, his hair goes in so many directions, he makes Einstein look like he just came from the hairstylist. But because he's a really bright guy, he runs a company called Palantir, P-A-L-I-N-T-I-R. Oh, yeah. And they have a thing, and he was talking about it at Davos, and then he did a CNBC interview. I'm going to try to play that in my update on Sunday, or if I get around to doing it midweek, I'll play some of that interview. He's talking about Palantir has a thing called Meta Constellation. So you can look it up, Meta, M-E-T-A hyphen Constellation, on the Palantir website, and you will see this graphic of the Earth with cameras circulating the Earth, and then these dot-like matrix, these dots all connected together down below. And what he was saying at Davos was that this meta-constellation is software that's been given, it's sort of artificial intelligence that's been given to Ukraine, and this is why Ukraine has been able to hold off big Russia in the war. And I believe it was in the CNBC interview, he said, listen, this type of software and artificial intelligence being introduced into warfare now, not just like into business and all this other stuff, being introduced into an active war situation makes Ukraine about as powerful as a nuclear power like Russia because of the software. So they can do much, much more in targeting things. And then you layer on top of that, you know, Elon Musk has wanted to cut off Starlink internet connection, the Starlink satellite internet for Ukraine, because they're using it to target people. But I don't know if Starlink can sort of cut off, well, you can use Starlink for your internet, but not for geopositioning. I don't know that they can divide it up like that. Maybe they can. I think it would be very difficult for them to do that. So the genie's out of the bottle on this technology stuff. I've also been talking about, and I think I can wrap it up with this, is these drones and everything that are being used. Now, I think in a Bible prophecy situation, this is very significant that Iran, Persia, is mentioned in the Bible as supplying drones and missiles to Russia. You know, and they're in Iran is against Israel, and there's big talk about, goodness, that's another rabbit hole we could go down. There's a lot of talk that, you know, maybe we may be days or weeks away from a massive United States-Israel joint operation against Iran. And Russia's already kind of complaining to Israel, you need to stay out of Syria and you need to stop doing what you're doing there. And Israel's saying, we're going to do it. And there's been some attacks on drone factories in Iran. So there's a lot of these things going on, but I would encourage people to go to look up the United Arab Emirates, Abu Dhabi, New Year's Eve celebration, and how they used the drones. The drones were used sort of as to create art in the sky. And one of the things that they created, and you need to think of this in terms of like Image of the Beast and these type of things, the technology that might be used for this, they created this giant head in the sky that was one of those like artificial intelligence heads that you see in technology graphics. But in the middle of it, it had in red AI, and it kind of flew through the sky and changed. And then they did one a few months before, they did one of the leader of the United Arab Emirates. And it was, you could look at the drones flying in the sky and you could tell who they were making a picture of. It was very, very clear. It was that detailed. And so when I look at it, I'm wondering is like, what's the military application for this? And what if somebody's using these drones? And we know they're using drones. They're buying the Chinese drones off the shelf and using them in the war in Russia, putting explosives on them or something else. And so it's changing the nature of warfare is the point. It's I think the one thing that seems to be doing is leveling the playing field and making like a country like Iran more powerful than they really are, or Ukraine more powerful than you would think that they would be on paper with the size of their troops compared to the size of Russians' troops. So it's all kind of very interesting, but when you throw that into an incredibly volatile world, you can kind of begin to understand when Jesus was talking in Matthew 24 about you'll see wars and rumors of wars. And I really think we're at that stage.
Well, there's neither side has got showing any inclination to want to end this war. You can't really see an end to it. Neither side's backing down. It suits the elite. It suits a depopulation type of agenda to have a war like this. The average person in Russia or the Ukraine is not benefiting from it. It's turned their lives upside down. There's hard to see a way out of it.
Well, let me just say this. I've personally struggled with some of the things going on Russia, Ukraine. Okay. So I'm not a fan of Russia. I think Russia, a lot of this is all on Russia And, you know, Putin says, well, I can't have you guys in NATO putting missiles close to me. So I'm going to invade a country and move my troops even closer to your troops, which seems kind of insane. And so I think Putin is a very evil guy, but and it's Russia's very corrupt country. But so is, you know, Ukraine has its own problems. But I've been trying to piece this together, Tony. So I just kind of came on something in the last week. I came across a video. It was on somebody's Twitter account, and it talked about Ukraine 2030. So I've played it in at least one or I think two of my prophecy updates that I've done. I think last Sunday I may have played it, or the Sunday before. And it talks about what we're going to do in Ukraine. And it's like a futuristic documentary made in 2030, looking back to 2023, which is kind of interesting timing. You know, it's 7 years. It talks about, you know, after the war in Ukraine ended in 2024, Ukraine became the first digital society, the first cashless society, and digital ID and all this stuff. And so I'm not sure if the agenda all along might have been to collapse Ukraine and build this World Economic Forum type perfect utopian society. I think I could make that case if I was going into court. And it sort of seems to fit, because why is everybody pushing Ukraine? It seems like, I mean, when you looked at the Davos sessions, it was like Ukraine for the most part, or Palestine. But there seems to be this fetish about Ukraine. So it may be that they're making money off the corruption, but it may be that they have big plans for Ukraine as to what they hope to do. And what we see with artificial intelligence and everything is really a lot of Tower of Babel type stuff. So if the pattern of scripture about the first Babel holds for the last Babylon, first Babylon to the last Babylon, I think we're going to see these things come together. I don't know how far they will get. I do not. I'm trusting that the Lord will intervene like he did at the Tower of Babel, that when people got too far, he just said, we got to go do something about it. And so I think with the way the technology is going, artificial intelligence, the war machines that are using it, the intrusiveness, the digital ID, the control, the social control, the central bank digital currencies that are coming, you know, it in using technology to make a lot of people worthless. I mean, I know people won't be too upset about this, but they're talking about, you know, an enhanced thing, the next step on from ChatGPT could get rid of 2/3 of the lawyers in the world, because you'll be able to just go to artificial intelligence and say, give me a contract, give me a mortgage, give me a lease agreement. And they'll be able to do most of it. You might just need a lawyer to put a couple pieces on it. There have been law firms that have been pushing for this and talking about doing this for years. So there, again, this is just this crazy convergence of things that we see everywhere. And it's very volatile, and it's disconcerting. I mean, it's hard to figure out what all is going on and who's deceiving us and who's on our side and who's not. I'm pretty sure that there's not too many people on our side.
Not people with power and might, that's for sure. That's what I think. I think the system is corrupt.
Well, I heard a statistic when I was driving around. It used to be that half of the assets in the world, like 10 years ago, were owned by the 500 richest people in the world. Now half of those assets are owned by 100 people. Mm-hmm. And that's so now you have these big tech titans. And I have some Bible prophecy friends, and I'm not going to say they're out of their minds. They're saying, are these big tech companies part of the beast, the heads of the beast that come together to form this final empire? And I'm not going to discount that at this point, because they're becoming they're very powerful. They're becoming even more powerful. So I think they bear watching in terms of Bible prophecy and how all this will unfold.
Yeah, no, that's true. And yeah, so much to watch. Like you started off saying the convergence, and there's so many things all at once happening. And I have to say, it is breathtaking. It's hard to keep up. It can be discouraging at times and overwhelming. But thanks, John, for bringing, you know, some of these things, your side of a picture that definitely bears a lot of consideration and thinking through a lot of this. So thank you again.
We were sort of talking about this the other day. It was like, we ought to get like a – it's hard to keep – you watch this stuff, Tony. It's hard to keep up.
Yeah.
There's so many different levels going, you know, and you got the coronation of King Charles coming up, which I think is kind of a significant thing, especially in light of that satanic ritual thing that took place at the Birmingham Commonwealth Games few months ago. So it's like we need this, like we need to have like a big symposium think tank, and we just come and talk about it and, you know, set aside like all the differences and agendas and that type of thing and say, okay, you know, we got a very complex thing going on here as this world is unfolding and seems to be rocketing to a conclusion. How do we as Christian leaders talk about that? And so I'll advocate for it, but I don't know if we'll ever get anywhere, but I would like to see something like that happen.
Fair enough. All right. Thanks, John. Well, we'll leave
Thank
it
you,
there,
Tony.
But let's get together again soon and do another one.
Look forward to it. Thanks, Tony.
Cheers. Folks, remember too, you can find John at Fellowship Bible Chapel on YouTube. And also remember, aminutetomidnight.com. Please subscribe to our website down the right-hand side of the page. Enter your email address and our Rumble, BitChute, YouTube and Apple podcast channels as well. And A Minute to Midnight, we do run it 100% by donations. A big thank you to people that are donating to help us. And if anyone else wants to do that, you can donate at aminutetomidnight.com. And the music used, I've written, played, and recorded. So that's it for this episode. God bless, and God willing, we'll be back with another one in a few days' time.